This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing Jean Kritzky, who's the author of a book called The Quest for the Perfect Hive, A History of Innovation in Bee Culture. Hi, Jean. How are you?
I'm doing well, David.
So before we talk about the book, maybe you could talk a little bit about your background and how you got interested in bees in the first place and what kind of research and teaching you do with bees.
Well, certainly. My first association with honeybees goes back to when I was in high school in Miami, Florida. A comb of wild bees had fallen out of one of the trees behind the apartment where I was living and landed on the ground, and I went out, and of course, being a nerd, I picked up all the cells I could, and I put bees at various stages in test tubes and took them to school, and they placed that on a display case for everybody to watch the bees develop over the course of the next week. And of course, the idea of having adult bees in test tubes gave me a lot of credibility with some of my friends, and the idea that I was handling stinging insects. So that's the first, my first brush with bees per se. But I really got focused on honeybees as part of my interest in history. I'm somewhat of a frustrated historian, even though I'm an entomologist. One of my primary areas of research is on the periodical cicadas, the 17-year locusts that some people refer to them. And I've been using tools of history and historical research to work on those insects for many, many years. And then in the 1980s, a wonderful woman by the name of Ava Crane wrote the book The Archaeology of Beekeeping. And this is a book that looked at evidence of past beekeeping, such as niches in garden walls and old straw beehives and legends and folklore about bees, and in particular these niches in garden walls just captivated me. The idea that this big square hole in a wall could be evidence of past beekeeping, I was amazed by that. And my goal at that time back in the 80s was to find more of these for science. And as my career developed, I ended up taking a sabbatical at Cambridge University in 2001. And for that project, I was transcribing Darwin's private research notes for The Descent of Man into MS Word. And if you've ever read Darwin's handwriting, it's atrocious. And I found myself having splitting headaches after about 2 hours and decided I needed a break. And then I realized I'm sitting in this wonderful manuscript room, this incredible library, and decided to turn my attention to the history of beehives. And before that year was through, I had visited over 150 niches in garden walls and discovered 8 new sets of bee niches. And as I was doing the research and working with the library, was able to create PDF files of every book in English from 1470 to 1700 that involved bees, and developed this massive resource. And out of this was coming a real sense of the story of where the modern beehive came from.
Well, it is, and of course, what you've just recapped in a lot of ways is what the book is about. I was interested by, the sort of idea of the interrelationship between human beings and bees. What you document in the book is, there's not as much information about really the earliest periods of history. So I think the first evidence you have is, some cave painting, maybe 7,000 years ago, which is more humans of that time simply taking honey, not necessarily raising bees, but knowing that there is something good in a beehive, which is certainly another interesting idea. If you can sort of imagine, how would the first person who ever found honey have done that? Probably by a hive falling out of a tree or something. But once human beings discovered honey, which obviously tasted good, there's some period there of development where the idea of keeping bees is introduced. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's a mystery there because you really don't know how or who could have done it.
But right. It's one of those. I would say it's speculative. What's the next step? Processes involved, but we know from what you're referring to from that cliff painting, are honey hunters, people who basically hunt for hunt for comb, and then rob the bees of their honey. And there's a lot of literature about how honey hunting, which continued into the last century. In fact, my wife's grandmother's brother was a honey hunter in Kentucky. And these individuals would go out and collect, they'd put a little bit of honey on a tree stump, and the bees would come in to feed on it to take that honey. They would actually capture the bees, walk away from the honey source, and let one bee away from this box that they put the bees in at a time, and see where it would fly, and follow that bee line as far as they could.
Right.
And then let a second one loose, and then eventually they'd find the tree that the bees were living in.
And steal the honey.
And steal the honey. And
now, is that destructive when they do that?
Well, sometimes it was. In fact, most of the times it was, especially when in the earlier days, they would cut the tree down and just take all the comb that they could and take that back to wherever they were living.
And that would destroy that particular colony.
Correct.
But then those bees would, I mean, obviously, you know, the way that bees organize their culture, essentially, is around the queen.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess most people know, but it is still fascinating to read about in your book. So if the hive is destroyed in that environment, the queen would then go establish a new colony?
Well, probably not. It depends if they used a decent amount of smoke and the bees thought the hive was on fire, it's quite possible that the queen, with enough workers who had filled their crops with honey, could go out and maybe start a new colony somewhere. But in many instances, she's not going to be able to go out singularly and start the process. She needs to have wax comb to lay her eggs, and her daughters basically tend to all the young. So unlike bumblebees, for example, she doesn't have the capability of starting it by herself.
Oh, that's so interesting. I mean, the biology of bees is kind of endlessly fascinating, I think.
Oh, it is, yes.
Because we're just not, it's so different from human culture to think about organizing around a single individual like that.
Mm-hmm.
But what you show in the book is, you know, the first evidence of essentially bee culture is really with the Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
And, but then, you know, what is interesting is and you spend a lot of time talking about beekeeping in the more historical period. I assume that's because the tools and evidence of beekeeping is hard to actually do archaeology on because it's not made of materials that persist. You know, if you have a hive and thousands of years go by, the hive will be gone.
In most cases, yes. In fact, it was just a few years ago at Tel Rahav in Israel that the oldest beehives have been found, and those are about 3,000 years old. Now, they're not the oldest record of beekeeping. We find those on tomb walls in Egypt, but at Tel Rahav, about 100 hives were found. They were horizontal hives, very similar to hives that are still being used in parts of the Middle East and Azerbaijan, Iraq today.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the interesting things about the book for me as a lay person, you know, not a beekeeper or even familiar with beekeeping history, was the variation in style of beekeeping and how those variations have persisted. In other words, you know, it's almost as if every invention has still maintained some adherence. Somewhere in the world, people will still keep bees in a way that was done maybe hundreds, maybe thousands of years ago somewhere.
That's true. In fact, in many cases, I sometimes think that we didn't develop beekeeping. We're basically just the bees did, and we're just sort of doing what we can to make them happy.
Right, or trying to figure out what it is that in a kind of cooperative way. It's maybe one of the unusual, maybe one of the most unusual relationships between human beings and another species. Because so often humans are, the power in the relationship is too great. I mean, humans are destructive or shape the species around our own needs.
Right.
In a way that, you know, obviously with raising cows, you now have a species of cow that is pretty distant from what cows were like when they were wild.
True.
Mainly suit the use of human beings.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly we have not changed bees the way we've changed cows.
Well, that's one thing that we're looking at now. A number of my colleagues, back in the days when we kept bees in straw basket, inverted baskets, the skeps, for example, it was very common for the beekeeper to lift the skep up, and if it was a really heavy skep with a strong colony with lots of honey, that'd be the bees that would be the hive they would kill.
Oh, so the irony is they're killing the one that's the most productive.
And so for several centuries, we were killing our best bees. And right now, and one of the problems that we're seeing in the United States with all the disease and whatever that we have with modern beekeeping is that we're going through what's called the genetic bottleneck. All the queen bees that we're using in North America right now are probably the descended from just 800 queens.
Wow.
So we've really dramatically, through our activities several centuries ago, started wiping out, selectively killing our best bees. And then today we're now inbreeding so much that the bees are having a genetic crisis. And that may be related to their inability to fend off disease and counter parasites that they're encountering.
And that, of course, I think more people have heard of these die-offs of bee colonies, and that's what you're relating it to. Is, in other words, that it's possible that the genetic stock of the bees has put them at risk for these kind of catastrophic die-offs.
Right.
That's a scary thought, and actually contradicts my initial thought that we had not influenced the bee genetics the way we have done with other species. It sounds like, again, this is another case of human beings inadvertently causing more damage than we realize.
We basically forgot about Darwin.
That's so interesting, because in many ways, agriculture and animal culture is Darwinian. You know, that human beings have observed nature and said, let me select for this characteristic that I really want.
Right.
Whether they knew Darwin or not, they were trying to breed for a particular purpose and altering the genetic history of that species to suit their needs. And here, and it's almost as if they were, as you said, forgetting Darwin, or not making sense even for their own purposes.
Right. They were killing the best and keeping the mediocre.
Right. Oh, that's a horrifying idea, actually.
Yeah.
Kind of giving me pause, because it makes me worry more. I was thinking that possibly, some of the things you talked about later in the book, after you've gone, well, and I should say, you go through pretty extensively the history of beekeeping. A lot of it is from the 17th century to the 21st century, pretty extensive documentation of all these different forms of beekeeping that have existed and different technology. You outline innovation in methodology, and it's pretty interesting even for me, as not a I have no knowledge of beekeeping really in any depth before I read this book, but I think one of the points that you suggest is that by looking at various forms of innovation in beekeeping over the last 200 or 300 years, modern beekeepers could learn some things about how to keep bees and how to prevent some of the problems that they're having now.
Oh, definitely. In fact, there's a new hive that's been developed in England called the Bee House.
H-A-U-S.
H-A-U-S.
The German style.
It's designed to look nice in the garden, which is very popular in Victorian England. They wanted something that would sort of complement the garden setting. But they've incorporated into that design what's called a long hive developed by Wells back in the 1890s. But they've also incorporated things that would help them clean the hive to lessen disease and so on. And that's the idea, that take what worked well in the past, couple it with the needs that we have present, and it's possible that we might develop hives that might help the situation.
Well, so tell me, in specific, if I were a backyard gardener and I wanted to keep bees, does it make sense to then just have a single hive? Is that kind of what you're suggesting?
Well, there's two different industries here. Of course, the professional beekeeper that's going to have thousands of colonies that are going to be selling, they'll be selling the honey to the major producers that we buy in the stores and so on. For the backyard beekeeper, and urban beekeeping is beginning to become more popular. I need to caution the listeners that if people are interested in keeping bees, they need to check with their local zoning ordinances to make sure that bees are not considered livestock by their local zoning laws because, and also there's some concern of litigation. Most of your neighbors will not differentiate between a wasp that stings them and your bee.
All right, that's a little tricky.
And so it gets a little more difficult. But in the past, it was very common, for example, in Central Park to have bees on top of the apartment complexes. Here in Cincinnati, where I live, there was a number of urban beekeepers downtown that had colonies on top of the flat roofs of different buildings in the center of the city.
Well, there's more. I mean, a huge increase in where I live in Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
fairly suburban. But what we've noticed is that over the last 5 years, the increase in the number of small farms and gardeners who are trying to bring back, whether it's commercial or whether it's semi-commercial, or urban gardens or community gardens, that seems to be increasing pretty rapidly. So one idea what you're suggesting possibly is that, let's say you had a community garden, you could introduce bees to the garden.
Oh, definitely. And indeed, the bees would then may produce higher yields of things like tomatoes and melons and pickles and so on. So you get a greater yield in your food that you're producing, but also you get this wonderful sweetener.
Well, and so for people who have heard, and because it's been in the news, so people have heard that there's this die-off, the colony collapse disorder,
mm-hmm.
CCD. So let's supposing you've heard that that's happened. You don't really know very much about it. What do you think? I guess I have two questions. One is, as an entomologist, what do you think is causing those collapses? And I know you mention in the book they've occurred probably in the past, but not on this scale.
Right.
What's causing them, and is there anything that let's say you are an amateur gardener and you are interested in bees and you're not afraid of beginning the process of learning about bees, do you think that the home gardener, the home beekeeper, could in fact contribute to overcoming the CCD problem?
Well, the primary thing with regard to overcoming, there's a conference just in the last couple of weeks of microbiologists that has found some more evidence that it looks like it might be a combination of a couple bacteria and some RNA viruses that are now linked to CCD. That's an important discovery, that there may be an organic cause. And once those can be verified, then there are possible drug treatments that can be used. My first professional work in beekeeping was as a state bee inspector for the state of Indiana. And it's very common in most states that bees need to be inspected to manage bacterial diseases, which they get. And you can treat bees with antibiotics and so on.
Now, do they get the... I guess this is another question that we can go off on a tangent on a little bit. When you mention the diseases, the bacteria, is that something that would have occurred in nature prior to the invention of human beekeeping?
Probably, yes. We see evidence from the literature going back to the 1500 AD, for example, that there was evidence of a number of diseases. Now, those bacteria were probably present in small percentages of the wild colonies, but it was the reuse of equipment and subsequent reinfection that tended to increase their numbers. And prior to the recent years, when I was inspecting, it was common to find anywhere between 4% and 10% of the colonies would be infected with one of the bacterial or viral diseases that we were aware of.
Right. So you can, when you say treat those diseases, what do they do?
Oh, we back for example, for American fowl brood, we just gave powdered terramycin to the bees in the spring of the year.
Wow.
And sort of put it in the sprinkle it on the top of the hive. The bees would go up there with powdered sugar. They'd get that, or put it in a pollen patty, and they'd go up there and collect that and eat that. That would rid the keep the bacteria under control, and the colony was fine. Now, with regard to the earlier question about for the hobbyist wanting to start, I manage the bees for a large cemetery here in Cincinnati, and so it's basically an urban beekeeping situation with just a handful of hives. We have four hives. One died over the winter. It didn't die of CCD. It's normal to have anywhere between 10 to 15, 20% die off, depending on how they're managed. In our case, the bees, we didn't have a very good honey flow last year, so we didn't have a lot of food reserves for them. and the bees in the one hive that died starved to death just inches away from lots of food. They cluster in the winter, and sometimes they just can't find the food if they're
in
that cluster.
And so there's no way for you to know that during the time that it's happening?
No, and you can't. You don't want to open the hive during the winter, because if you break into the cluster, you can that can cause more problems.
Got it.
So that's just an unfortunate thing that happens. But for a hobbyist, having one colony of bees that they manage well and leave a good reserve of honey for the bees to survive over the winter, if they spring feed and treat appropriately with to keep the mites down and keep the viral disease, the bacterial diseases down, they should be quite successful. The big die-offs that have been reported are occurring in the largest numbers with the professional beekeepers, the people who put hundreds of bees on the back of a flatbed truck and drive them to California for almonds, then up to Washington State for apples, and then over into the Minnesota for berries, and then down into Texas for cotton, and then back the next year back for almonds and so on. Those are the groups that we're seeing the greatest die-offs.
Bees as migrant workers.
That's true. Yeah, they were, and that's not something new that we've done. In fact, back in the 18th century, in what's now Slovenia, they used to have these wagons that had the hives like kept in these big high top wagons like dresser drawers. They would actually cart them all over the place to pollinate.
Well, it's a really interesting thing. Now, if you had a, let's say you have a backyard beekeeping operation, you only have one hive, how many pounds of honey would a hive produce in a year, as you suggest, leaving enough in reserve for the bees themselves?
Well, basically, on a good year, now last year was not a good year, this year is looking a little better, you could realize between 50 to 75 to 100 pounds, depending how strong that hive is, usually about 50 pounds to 75 pounds of honey you would be able to take off per colony, and that would still leave a decent amount of honey for the bees to overwinter.
I think that's a pretty attractive number. 50 pounds of honey is a lot of honey.
That's a lot of honey. Consider you're buying half-pound jars. That's 100 jars of honey, and most people don't eat 100 jars of honey.
Not in a year, I
not
think.
In a year.
No, there are a couple of, I'm sure this is true for almost everyone, because there are amateur beekeepers almost everywhere in America, but just near me, I know one guy who sells honey out of his garage, and I think he's only got three hives. He produces a ton of honey. Or it seems like a ton to us.
Right.
Do you think, for the person who's interested in beekeeping or bees, whether they do it themselves or work with others who do it, is there a lot of equipment involved now where you have to, you document in this book an amazing array of different ways that people have come up with beekeeping equipment. Usually we imagine the outfit that protects
right.
the beekeeper. I assume, and what you've indicated is it hasn't changed that much, even though the materials are different.
It still looks very similar to some of the new sheriff system that I'm using. It's reminiscent of a 16th century woodcut that I have in my collection.
Right, I think that was in the book.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's fascinating. So, what does it cost to buy a beekeeping outfit that would protect you from being stung?
Oh, that runs about anywhere between 30. If you buy the jacket, you're probably looking at $35 to $65 for a jacket. You're probably looking at about $65, $75 for the full coverall suit with the veil and so on.
So it's not, this is not exotic and
right, no.
stuff. So, and are there people who really are able to work with bees who don't have to wear protective clothing, or is that sort of a mythology, a myth of the, kind of like the bee whisperer idea?
It depends on the bees you're using. In England, there's a wonderful a variety of bees, which is so docile that I remember taking out a frame and actually petting the bees with my hand.
Wow.
And now over here, where there's a lot more wilder bees, I usually tend to wear a veil. That's the screening system in front of your face. But if you know your bees well and you're careful with them, they know you. I don't use gloves anymore, because you have more control barehanded, and it's almost like a Tai Chi exercise.
Mm-hmm.
If you have nice, smooth, fluid movements, and the bees know you're just going to be there for a few minutes at a time, they don't get that upset.
So, do you think the bees really respond to the person who is the beekeeper? Do they really develop a relationship?
Well, it's hard to say whether they develop a relationship or if a person's not careful, they're banging away, if that really gets them upset.
Right. So it is almost, whether it is a relationship or not, but it does have to do with the manner in which you relate to the bees.
Yeah, there's a wonderful mythology called the Telling of the Bees that occurred in Europe and England, and of course England and Ireland back the last several hundred years. If a beekeeper should pass away, they would drape the skeps or the hives in black crepe and then walk around it, tapping a key on the hive, and they'd be telling the bees, you know, your master is gone, but I'm going to be your new master, and so on. And in many cases, it was always felt that that would keep the bees from swarming and disappearing for the new beekeeper. Basically, if someone's going to go to that kind of extreme and care, they're going to be a good beekeeper.
Yeah, it's great. I think this is a wonderful book, and I think it might surprise people because I think a lot of people really don't understand how interesting the life of humans and bees can be. I really thank you for talking to me today. This has been Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Gene Kritsky, the author of The Quest for the Perfect Hive, A History of Innovation in Bee Culture. It's a book I recommend. Thanks a lot, Gene.
Well, thank you.